But then we did just want to we did just want to quote one of the paragraphs from that. It's at the end on page 62, and we're talking about light and darkness. Light and darkness are the world's eternal ways. By one, a man goes not to return. By the other, he cometh back again soon upon the earth. Know, devotee, O son of Pritha, who knoweth these two paths, is ever deluded. Wherefore, O Arjuna, at all times be thou fixed in devotion. The man of meditation who knoweth all this reaches beyond whatever rewards are promised in the Vedas or that result from sacrifice or austerities or from gifts of charity and goeth to the supreme, the highest place. So the title, as we said, is The Cycles of Death and Rebirth. It's a panel discussion today, and we will be having two speakers, one on death, and one will discuss the ideas in rebirth. So we're going to start with death. And it's interesting, since we are looking this month at the idea of cycles, people would say, what does death and rebirth have to do with cycles? But if one does not have an understanding of reincarnation and only has an idea of the one life, then of course they're not going to understand that death and rebirth are cycles. And these ideas, death and rebirth, are two of a primary importance when one is studying the philosophy of theosophy, because it is said in regards to death that, granted, this physical form may die, but the real man, the higher self, does not die. Those three, Atma, Buddhi, and Manas, are what is reincarnating, and we will look at that closer with the next talk. But it is important to realize that when one dies, it's just another plane of existence. That in it is thought that the person doesn't even realize, once they have moved out of their physical frame, that they have actually died, because they're not dead. And we think that can be a very comforting thought, that we do not die. It's only this form. Identifies with this form in an extreme way. We just can't imagine not having a body. But once this body is no longer able to sustain itself, then that higher self moves on, and we will go into shortly the first after death state. And the second after death state will be followed up with our second talk. So, because many people do not understand how this works, and it is what we will try to do to assist people to understand what this idea of cycles and death and rebirth are about. So one of the things we need to understand is that in regards to death and rebirth, is that the human is a sevenfold being. We have four lower that are considered to be transient. That's the human body. We have that life force. We have, we just lost it. We have, oh, the astral body, and we have kamma, which is the how we it is the lower ideas that we have. And then we have the three higher, as was said. And it is important that we understand the fourth one, kamma, or desire, which also is one of the lower four that is transient. That we need to understand that that is one of the things that attaches us to the body. Lower mind and desire kind of weld together. And sometimes, depending upon how strong the force is of that desire, that will oftentimes determine much of our after-death states. So, if one does understand this idea of reincarnation, it'll be an easier path to understand the cycle of death and rebirth. And what you will hear today is very different from the standard one-life idea of it. So, some people ask, is there a heaven or hell? And we will understand that. The second after death state, Devakan, is often considered heaven, whereas the first one, Kamaloka, is considered to be almost like a hell. So, what happens when somebody dies? Well, it seems as though that physical form, the heart isn't pumping, they can't get a blood pressure. You know, the eyes are fixed and dilated, all those signs of what is death. But in reality, the brain is still very busy. And what happens is there is an experience, it's called a review. And when the person dies, there's a review of minute detail of that person's entire life. It could be things that are seen just in the periphery of someone's life, but it goes into, it is not general by any means. It is quite the opposite. It's in detail. So the brain at this point is considered very busy. And when that work is done, then it is considered that that person is gone. The astral, which we discussed on Wednesday, and we will finish discussing the astral this coming Wednesday, detaches itself from the physical body, and the life energy is gone, and some of the lower principles are gone. So what happens then is that it joins. So what happens then is that it joins with, well, we lost our spot. We're sorry. So it joins the astral and the lower and kamma, they join together. And this is called the kamma rupa. And it means desire body. And it goes into the first stage of the after-death state. And what happens there is that it is looking at all the lower desires that have occurred during that person's life. And these are all sloughed off. They're not needed anymore, but there are impressions that remain and are carried on into the next life. So when this all happens, it is actually a good thing that is going on. And sometimes, depending upon how attached that person has been during life, when, you know, say they're a strong materialist, then when this happens, they could stay in that kamalogic state for a while. But if it's a highly, even not a highly spiritual person, but a spiritual person nonetheless, so when this happens, then the sloughing off is quick, and then it's gone. Now, in the meantime, the higher triad of spirit, of Buddhi, and of higher mind, they only hang around in Kamaloka for a short time. They go into Devakan. So the lower mind, then, along with the passions and desires, they function whatever it is they have to do in Kamaloka, and then when that is done, they dissipate. So what happens then? So what causes all of this? There's an idea called tanha, which is the thirst for life. And especially with Kamaloka, if this thirst for life is very, very strong, as we said, then that person will remain in Kamaloka for a longer period of time. So then there is it. Oh, we wanted to just mention cremation, because if the body is gone quickly, then it is said, it is thought that's whole idea of being in Kamaloka, things kind of move on a little more quickly. So it is kind of, you know, of course you do what you want, but it is suggested that it is an assist to the body if we do have, the astral will dissipate quicker if there is cremation. So what is the practical use of knowing this about the Kamarupa, which is the form, and Kamaloka, which is the place? I mean, why do we need to know this? Well, just knowing about the after death states help us to identify more with this idea of cycles. And knowing what death truly is, that it is not an ending. It is actually beneficial, and it is a supportive type of an idea, because it's good to know that if we have any problems, any concerns, anything between friends, family, whatever, that we will have another chance to rectify and balance out the universe. So this idea of Kamaloka is needed. It wipes clean these lower passions and desires so that we can move on to the higher and work on our ideas of a higher nature without these lower ideas interfering and diverting our thoughts. So we'll go on to the second cycle, the second after death state of Devakan.
William Q. Judge wrote a very lovely, very succinct statement. He wrote that life is not the result of the operation of the organs, nor is it gone when the body dissolves. It is a universally pervasive principle. It permeates the globe and every being and object on it, and it works unceasingly on and around us, pulsating through us forever. So we've just heard about how life proceeds, spirit proceeds far beyond the physical grave or cremation, and that physicality of the personality is a melting of the physical chaos of the life just led. It's the chaos of all those lower passions and desires. And these certainly proceed on with effect, but for the moment, they are dissipated in terms of forcing energy in that particular incarnation. Life, consciousness, soul, Atma Buddhi Manas, however you want to consider the essence of the eternal pilgrim, continues on to another state of being. So these after-death states are not places. They're not destinations. They are states of consciousness for the eternal pilgrim who is just completing a particular incarnation. Devakan is an old Hindu term, meaning the land of the gods. It refers to a period, again, of a dissipation of force, an expenditure of force created by the eternal pilgrim, by the life just led. And it's resting, it's dreaming, it's an assimilation state, it's an effect state. So in this, quote, land of the gods, which truly is a state of consciousness, there's a duration or a time between periods of birth when each soul exists in a godlike fashion within his surviving mind. The nature of a person's thoughts and emotions during the life led will create this heaven state, if you will. All men, all souls living human state lives with many worthwhile thoughts and desires have far more than their lower passions and desires. All soul creates affirmations, creates aspirations, hopes that frequently are checked by karma that cannot be completed during a particular incarnation. And that force that's generated by the soul, that thought, that aspiration, remains in the real part, the eternal part of man, and demands a mental assimilation, an energy absorption, if you will, in the devachanic state of mind. These states of mind are such that the leftovers of mind force used by the soul in the current incarnation builds its own world. It's a subjective state, Devakan is. And the state lasts for duration as long as the nature of the person demands it. Some souls are exhausted by the efforts that they face with karmic effect during a physical life. Other souls are not exhausted. But the most important qualities of the life just led, our motives, our attitudes of mind, the stuff, the aroma that is formed through experience provided by use of a brain and are retained as moral instincts. These aspirations, these lofty passions and pure desires of the life just led can be experienced in the devachanic state, can be lived out in the mind at that plane of consciousness. And gradually in this assimilation process, the heart language, the language of the soul, the font, the building of wisdom available to the Bodhi principle, all of this grows in the inner stature as part of the assimilation of the forces that have been engendered during life. This state, this heaven state, while life goes on for the soul in the state, that soul is unreachable by mediumistic practices. That soul exists on the plane of the eternal, Atma, Buddhi, Manas. And in that Devakonic state, it is said that masters may interact with the mind soul left in the assimilation state. It is said that the pure divine love is not merely the blossom of a human heart, but has roots in eternity, and that spiritual, holy love is immortal. Therefore, there are many teachings that there's a providential protection that's offered by the Devakani, and that there is a strong shield that's possible, unlimited by space and time. Now, all of this state is a natural sequence. It's a natural effect of the forces engendered, the attachments involved in the life just led. But as Judge wrote earlier, life pulsates. The soul can emerge just as the sun rises and flowers bloom. The other panelists referred to tanha, the thirst for life. That's a natural impulse that arises within the spiritual and astral realms, finds expression in the magnetic, the electromagnetic attractions that the soul has left behind life after life after life. And skandhas are produced, bundles of tendencies and traits that also need to be expressed, explored, experienced, elevated by soul. These are tools of karma, a compassionate law that creates for the soul a new attraction back into a re-embodiment, a new personality, a reincarnation in which the eternal pilgrim exists and expresses itself once again in new ways. It's as though electricity finds its way back to a new bulb and for a new expression of the form of electricity. So we're reminded in rebirth that the actor, the true eternal pilgrim, is picking up a new role, putting on a new costume. And that re-embodiment, again, is an opportunity of rebirth and reestablishing the process of progress, the process of self-determination, introspection, the process of impressing all of nature, all kingdoms of nature, for the better. So ultimately speaking, when we're considering these cycles of birth and death, and while we might physically or emotionally grieve the loss of companions on this plane, those of us that have been privileged or perhaps challenged to be at the passing, to be at the death experience of a loved one, are very aware that what we most connected with, what we most loved and appreciated and found oneness with, departs from the physical plane, is completely gone. And it is that spiritual tie, that spiritual oneness, that offers us many ways of preparing during life for an easier transitional state, an easier passing of death in the physical, an easier duration of the need for Kamaloka, an easier, more transitory need for a Devakonic state. And ultimately, there are daily practices that would also ease the rebirth the reincarnation of those souls that would very much like to be altruistic, and very much would like to work in a theosophical movement on behalf of the whole, on behalf of all. So while these after-death states are merely effect states, there's no true objective analysis and causation. They are indeed a preparation for a rebirth in which mind, body, soul, spirit, however we want to define it, once again communes on this plane for a period of creative activity. Rebirth, regeneration, the reestablishment of light. So we're sure that in this period of darkness in this month, you've come to this morning's session with your own observations and comments and questions. SL.
Besides our common experience of cycles and the operation of cause and effect, are there any experiences we go through as human beings that are analogous, that might help us understand the state of mind in either Kamaloka or Devakan?
What comes to mind immediately is what we experienced in a 24-hour cycle. We have a period of time in which we are physically active on this plane. We are using as many of the seven principles as we can avail ourselves of. And eventually we're exhausted. We're overwhelmed by the force of life, and the physical needs to be put down for a period of rest. And again, that period of rest for the physical is established by the nature of the activities, the motives, the stress, that the attachments that are created during the course of the day. All of us experience, successfully or not, putting the physical body down for sleep. We experience REM activity that can be noted medically on this plane. We go through a stage of transition of a dreamlike process of REM on our way as soul, as mind beings into deep sleep. And then as that period of duration is established in peace and calm and rejuvenation is regeneration for the physical is reestablished, this cycle then proceeds upwards. And again, the soul moves through a transition, dreamlike series of states until finally we emerge in the earliest awakenings with a sense of pure existence. Then gradually, a state of minds, we daily accrue more realizations. Oh, the room is hot. Oh, I have a lot to do today. Oh, I'm this personality. I'm that duty. And the busyness of the mind and personality rejoins with the physical, the mental, the spiritual, the astral, the psychic. So we all experience those cycles. We all trust when we put the body down for rest in the evening that there will be a new tomorrow. Upon awakening, the sense of I am is there. That reflection of the eternal exists. And gradually, memories of the past, events of the past, causes and effects that we've set up the previous day or so, come back in for a new period of activity and expression.
We have a question, comment here in Theosophy Hall.
So, Kama in itself doesn't mean lower desires, it just means desire. And we color it with our mind principle, manas, whether it's higher or lower. And after all, there's the expression desire first arose in it, which is the unknowable, the impulse to emanate each new day of the evolutionary journey. And it's interesting that we call Kamaloka a state, Devakan. Kamaloka, loka means place, but it's really a state. But as material as we are right now, we are also in a state. And when we are in those other states, our consciousness is fully on that plane or that state, which we guess would be like a place. So it's just, we just find it kind of curious the way words work.
Yes, and the idea of kama can be colored as to however our mind is functioning at the time, because we know that there are higher desires, of course, especially spiritual ones, compassionate ones, that sort of thing. And then the idea of the lower desires, which is what kind of, you know, binds us to this form and to earth, all the distractions we have. So it is a battle for us to try and elevate and be consistent with this idea of keeping. And that's what it suggests about meditation and thinking and reading, watching things of higher nature to help elevate those lower desires and keep them, you know, elevated. It is work, but it is something that, especially with the after death states, will help us in that endeavor.
And it's very important to recall that passion is an eternal principle. Like the life force, it is eternal. It is a radiation of that absolute. And when we consider something in daily life, like habit formation, we know that if we've got a habit we would like to extinguish or eradicate, we need to substitute some thinking and value for another activity on the thought plane, on the word plane, in action, literally. And again, during that process of being introspective, I see this habit or trait, I would like to replace it with something loftier. We make a consistent effort to use the imagination to transform recollections into reminiscence to more and more ethereal, universal planes of thought. And it's not so far away. You know, for the caretaker, the parent, the grandparent, the teacher, the physician who is taking care of a very young body of an old soul that's come back, there is an intense, pure, compassionate love and sense of oneness with the tiny little face that's being cared for. But that is limited in the experience of that one caregiver and that one infant. It's a materialistic but pure expression of universal brotherhood, of true spiritual unity. And how do we transmute that? How do we raise it back up to a compassionate law of karma? But in our loving moment with the little one, we substitute or add an additional thought, a wish. May all young bodies, all old souls returning to life be loved as much as you. May we all be at one in that peace and brotherhood and love. In that way, we elevate our thinking, we bring the use of passion back to the highest expression rather than a relatively materialistic And it's something that we can all do for ourselves and others. There was a chat that came in. Yeah. How do you reconcile your own physical death when it will leave others, such as disabled children, in peril? There is the greatest of all quandaries, isn't it? It might be disabled children. It might be a dependent spouse or a degenerating friend. We may sense that there is a tremendous burden of duty that's left undone. And for some, the level of anxiety and attachment, I need this physical frame, I need this physical personality in order to take care of that one, that kind of attachment and materialistic thinking adds to the anxiety. So what if we prepare during life as best we can for the death, the termination of the physical, when we can no longer physically care for the disabled child, the dependent friend, the beloved spouse. How would we do that? Well, we can use logic as coolly and calmly as possible and do all in our physical ability to raise the funds needed to be left for an inheritance for that one that needs care. We may take as many steps as we can while in a physical body to empower others to continue caring for the one that needs the comfort and the sustenance once we're gone. We can do everything in our power to set up the conditions karmically so that there are substitutes who will carry on in the life of this dependent loved one. Having said that, in our periods of meditation and preparation, we remind ourselves that all is under a compassionate law of karma. That is, eternal souls, as eternal pilgrims in the devachanic state, our aspirations for the dependent one will be expressed and brought to a lofty conclusion, and that the eternal love and compassion that we feel for just that one will generate support even in the devachanic state. And then we trust to the law that we've done everything we can in our period of physical and personal expression. And we lean on a compassionate law of karma that the conditions to care for the other will continue on.
And we think it would be very comforting to know, as was just said, that in Devakan, whatever is undone for that soul of a higher nature will be accessed and looked at, and that soul, and people need to understand that the love, that strong love and that strong compassion of that soul in Devakan many times can be felt towards the one that is left on earth. So we think that's a very comforting thought, that should a caregiver have to leave a child or a loved one behind, that their love and compassion and caring will still be able to affect that. How long in years is the devachanic state for the average person? Well, the term average person is kind of a It's a huge idea because everybody's different. And Devakan is supposedly an average of 1,500 years, but it depends on the spiritual aspirations of the person. And it is said that if a person is very spiritual, sometimes the masters will tap them to come out of Devakan early. It is a period of rest that is needed by the soul. And one does not want to come out too soon before all these higher aspirations have been dealt with and impressed for the next life. So it cannot be said how many years does an average person stay in Devakan, because there are so many variables to that. And there's a comment here in Theosophy Hall.
Well, we can look at historical cycles where things seem to repeat themselves, not exactly, but where certain, just like today's, the United States seems to be at a reiteration in a sense of the Roman Empire, and we can see a lot of similarities. So it's true that some people can come back very quickly, others by certain practices can prolong their Devakan for many thousands of years. So, but we can look at the historical cycle.
So the comment and contribution was that we can look at the past and we can see repetitions of different ways of life, and we can kind of determine how long those folks may have been in the after death states.
There's also a thought, and you can do your own study in the literature on this, that there are daily practices that we can do in order to harmonize our efforts in life with what the efforts out of physical life is going to be like. We can accelerate this duration, this need for after death states being 1,000 to 1,500 years. So it's recommended that instead of leading a day in a chaotic fashion, like a ball in a pinball machine, where we're reactive to different events and experiences and just kind of scattered in our use of force, it's recommended that we begin each day with a period of reflection and meditation to set the tone for the day. This would echo what the Eternal Pilgrim is about as they emerge from the state of consciousness known as Devakan and have a clear moment of vision before reassuming a physical form for a new incarnation. So we can set the tone in a period of meditation in the morning. We can lead our daily life in a reflective, responsible, harmonious, peaceful, calm kind of sequence of events, causes and effects, and try to remain as mindful as possible throughout the course of the day, as one-pointed as possible in our multitasking world. That will help to disarm or diffuse any kind of chaotic lower passions and desires. And then it is taught that at the end of the day, when we're preparing the physical body for deep sleep, we can set a period of meditation in which there's a review of the past day. And so what's going on there is there's a mindful consideration of the events of the day, our reactions and responses to those events, the causation and motives that we've set up. And again, it's diffusing energy that has been scattered that is less than supremely altruistic. And it's a peaceful regrouping, if you will, akin to the final review that the soul does through the brain upon the physical death. In that way, we establish the use of force and energy day by day in a particular way that can shorten the after-death states. And why would we want to shorten the need for the after-death states? Well, as the earlier comment was made, that motive to care for another, to empower another to exist as best they can, that's our dharma. That's our goal in life. That's what we want to bring back as quickly as possible into this plane. That's what those souls that have achieved nirmanakaya status have achieved.
SL, and then we have some chats.
There's quite a few chats there, so I'll waive my question.
Oh, thank you. So the first one is the term old soul was used. Have some souls experienced more cycles of death and rebirth than others? How does this work? Well, we know that at least in the modern vernacular, that when somebody says that, oh, he's an old soul, it usually indicates somebody who is wise and compassionate, knowledgeable about things. But the term old soul, we don't know if that actually is. Does my companion have an idea about that?
Well, yeah, we all have that instinct to quantify, don't we? So if the teaching is that 18 million years ago, give or take, mind, spirit, and matter communed, and we have achieved the physical human state that we experience now. Well, if we divide 18 million by about 1,000 or 1,500, we get a quote, typical pattern of the number of incarnations that any soul has experienced. And again, this is, how do you average something? How do you measure something? How do you quantify something? But old soul, again, refers to a reminder for the parent, the grandparent, the teacher, that although the child may appear as young and helpless and inexperienced, they still have lessons to bring to the adults around them. There was also a comment before the old soul chat. How does theosophy account for the current world population of 8 billion people? Were there 8 billion people 1,500 years ago on Earth? Again, can we quantify it? No. It is said that the Mahatmas or the Masters have a sense of the cosmic, and they've gained the wisdom, the insight over spirit and all matters of kingdoms and cycles of manifestation. So if we think about the current world, unfortunately, there's an avalanche of souls leaving in very violent circumstances. We're all very aware of that. We also know there's another natural avalanche of the Great Generation and the baby boomers leaving the planet in large numbers. We will never know how many souls actually exist on the planet at any one time. How can we count all of the souls in all of the locations? And why would we want to? We're told that life pulsates and does so under law. So it's not a finite number of souls. There are some on the planet, some leaving the planet and just entering Kamaloka, others of them leaving Devakon and just re-entering onto the planet in new bodies We don't know. I don't think we'll ever know. Co-panelists, do you have a...
I'm trying to find that one. Well, can you repeat that, please?
How does theosophy account for the current world population of 8 billion people? Were there 8 billion people 1,500 years ago on Earth? And I don't know the validity of the 8 billion people right now anyway, let alone 1,500 people. So
then the next one is, oh, we did the old soul.
And
we have a comment or a question here in Theosophy Hall on this.
Well, regardless of how many people are in the world, it seems as though the best way, based on what you're saying, is that to prepare adequately for transitioning in the next world, one must die before you die. Am I getting that correct?
What was that? One must die before one dies?
To prepare for death, you should die before you die. At least that's what the adepts would tell the chelas who are wishing to become like the masters.
You die with flesh.
Well, if we think about the fact that as soul, we can either experience life purely physically and personally, like a ball in a pinball machine, and create a random chaotic experience, or we can extinguish that tendency, that animalistic tendency, therefore make it die out. And as soul, we can live instead in a harmonious, soulful, spiritually mental and psychic state in which there is a harmonious life. And so in that way, certain traits die out, other traits are rejuvenated.
Yes, that whole thought that in order to live, we must die. So the old ideas, the old ways of acting, the old ways of feeling have to die so that there can be a rejuvenation then of new thoughts, new patterns, and try and get all of this together so that we can have a more spiritual life. And then we can, and then when we do die, so we think that that second death can be the physical one, and the initial death will be of those old terrestrial thoughts and feelings.
We have a series of chats that have been waiting for quite a while, and we're almost out of time.
Oh, it's 12 o'clock. I don't know what.
Well, incarnation does work under the laws of karma, so that karma actually governs everything in terms of insight and reasoning, et cetera. It's all being brought forth from prior existence. And as physicalities, we are dying from the moment that we are born. That's part of the fun. So that's it, isn't it? Our time is up.
Well, it certainly did generate a lot of ideas. Thank you, everybody.
Bye-bye.